Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the water, the tank has been reopened. Hello, everybody. Mike Bloom here, back with the Shark Tank podcast here on Reality TV Wrap-Ups. But I am not alone. I am joined, as I was last time, by Jasmeet Sidhu. Jasmeet, welcome back.
Hello. So glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So we were very delighted to hear the response after the first podcast. We were happy to hear so many Shark Tank fans out there in the universe of Rob Has a Podcast. And so as a result, you know, you bought into our offer. And so we have a great partnership going. Maybe we'll have a Beyond the Tank-esque episode one time where we'll get lots of feedback from you guys about how you think we're doing. But we're back and we're going to talk about some more Shark Tank. We'll talk specifically about this week's Shark Tank. But just so you guys know, the plan right now is for us to do recaps episodically up until the finale of season 7. Now, unfortunately, that's only about a month or so of episodes, but we thought it'd be sort of a great start, a great jumping in point for the season. And then once we have that summer break, we'll sort of go from there. But Jasmine, for those who may not have tuned into our intro podcast, you are very new to RHAP as a podcaster. So do you want to give a little brief background about yourself?
Sure. I'm new to RHAP as a podcaster, but not new at all to the podcast itself. I've been listening to RHAP for almost 5 years now, and have been a longtime Survivor fan since episode one and a longtime Shark Tank fan. I've seen most of the episodes for most of its 7 seasons. On the personal side, I live out here in San Francisco, where I work at a VC-funded startup in Silicon Valley. And before that, I was working at Facebook and had started a successful nonprofit. And I think those were a couple of reasons why I was drawn to Shark Tank initially in the first place as an investment reality show, merging sort of both sides of my life. And I was so excited to hear that we wanted to do a Shark Tank podcast. So here I am.
Awesome. And you guys who listen to Rob Has a Podcast might know me from my work on Last Comic Standing, Celebrity Apprentice, a bunch of other things, Top Chef, a slew of things on post-show recaps. What you might not know is that I graduated from school with 2 degrees in theater and economics. And I talked last week about how I feel Shark Tank is the perfect intersection, the middle of that Venn diagram between the two subjects, because it is very business heavy. There are a lot of economic terms thrown about in these presentations, but at the same time, it is a TV show. It is fun. Sometimes it can kind of be hokey, but in a good way. A few of these sharks are definitely blowing up their personalities to make for good TV. We'll even see one big example with a film and television actor as a shark on this week's episode. It's a perfect merger of reality TV and the interest that I've gained in the BAs that are currently framed on the wall of my apartment right now. So I felt it was a perfect intersection. We're happy it was also an intersection between RHAP and the audience as well. We can't thank you guys enough again for the feedback. Keep it coming. We want to hear from you guys. I mean, this is a very storied history of the show as well. And like Jasmeet, I haven't seen all the episodes, but I've seen a good amount, all the kind of pop into frame on CNBC Monday through Friday nights. I've been trying to also watch, you know, episodes that really highlight certain products, but I'm always game to get suggestions of episodes to watch. So that give us some jumping off points.
I was going to say our spinoff podcast could be called Beyond the Podcast instead of Beyond the Tank.
Yeah,
just like, you know, following us in our own lives and how successful we are, obviously.
I love that. Yeah, someone will come to you. We had a bunch of people in New York the past week for Live Know-It-Alls. We could have very easily sat one of us down and just, you know, talk to us about these are the episodes of Shark Tank you should watch. Maybe take us into, I don't know, a room filled with TVs so we can actually film the watching experience. It would be great. Now, we talked about the aforementioned film and television actor, which I think segues perfectly into our talk about the sharks for this week. As we talked about, it is a rotating panel of 6, but there is a chance that here and there guest sharks will pop up. This week, there was no Barbara Corcoran. There was no Daymond John. Instead, we got Ashton Kutcher. And we're going to use this opportunity to clarify a couple things that we talked about in last week's podcast. Jasmeet, do you want to talk a little bit about Ashton Kutcher and the things we've discovered about his entrepreneurial efforts in the past week?
Yeah, for sure. So this is Ashton Kutcher's second time as a guest shark this season. So occasionally they do bring in guest sharks that are outside of the 6 that they regularly rotate in. I think in this episode, he's replacing Daymond John and Barbara Corcoran. The second week without Barbara Corcoran, and she's my favorite shark.
Well, technically, I mean, we do get a little taste of her. She was down in Cabo St. Lucas, right?
We're going to get a taste of her this episode. So I got my Barbara fix this episode. We'll talk about that later. But last week, we were questioning a little bit, Ashton Kutcher, like, does he have sort of deep knowledge in tech investments? And I knew he had a little bit, but, you know, for preparation for this week's episode, I read a little bit more about what he's actually been doing and how he got involved with Shark Tank. So for those who are curious, you know, I think he's most well known for That 70s Show, Two and a Half Men, sort of this goofy character he tends to play. But in real life, he seems to be a bit of a savvy tech investor. He became friends with Mark Cuban, and Mark Cuban was actually the one who invited him to try out to be a guest investor on Shark Tank. And he actually has his own venture capital firm called A Great Investments. And back in 2009, he was an investor in Skype. And since then, he's been involved in seed and Series A rounds for really huge companies, including Uber, Airbnb, Spotify, Casper Mattresses, which is actually, I think, a sponsor of Rob Has a Podcast every now and then.
Yeah, that's some synergy there. Maybe Rob can have Ashton Kutcher on one time.
Exactly. So, you know, we initially thought, like, why is a celebrity like Ashton Kutcher in here? It makes a lot of sense for him to be here. I think he's someone that adds a lot of flavor to, you know, the regular rotation of Sharks. And I think he's someone with a little bit of star quality that I think they want, you know, Mark Burnett and the team, they want to try to bring in new viewers. So I think he's a fun addition. What do you think of Ashton Kutcher?
Yeah, after watching an episode of him, again, I hadn't seen him on at all this season with his one previous guest stint, but I thought he brought a lot of energy and surprisingly positivity to it. I know he talked about how Lori might be considered the warm-blooded shark, and I know some people might not necessarily agree with that, but I feel like Ashton was like firm but almost supple at the same time, in that, you know, I think he bought into some of these products that not a lot of the other sharks would have done. And I think he definitely sort of represents the more younger younger spirit that Silicon Valley and entrepreneurship kind of represents these days, these people in their 20s and 30s that have a boatload of money and decide to invest in these bright, new, brave ideas. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can't go wrong with the guy who does a happy dance at the end of the episode.
Of course, yeah.
Though, again, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the, like, this episode on and showing moments from it, because when I saw almost, it was almost like spoiling me that I knew when Ashton was doing his happy dance, I thought, okay, he's going to take that deal at the very end of the episode. Though I don't think there are many deals, final deals in the episode that don't end with somebody at least getting some sort of money out of it.
Right. I think with the guest sharks, this is just for me watching, you know, a couple episodes with the guest sharks. Whenever you have one on, you're definitely going to see them get involved with the deal. Otherwise, it's like, their contribution was kind of pointless to the show. So I knew that Ashton Kutcher was going to get some sort of deal in this episode. I wasn't sure which one, but, you know, we'll talk about that when we get there.
Absolutely. And in terms of his background, it's totally eye-opening, though. I mean, I would think if I was a producer, you just see that this guy played Steve Jobs in a movie, and that would be credit enough for me to put somebody on. But that's probably why I
forgot about that,
TV.
The other Steve Jobs movie.
Yeah, I think that's the movie that nobody wants to remember, is that the other Steve Jobs movie. There is one clarification I want to provide as well about Mr. Mark Cuban. Now, unfortunately, Jasmine and I both share the same blind spot in the sports world. And so when we heard in the intro, Mark Cuban, the outspoken owner of the Dallas Mavericks, I don't know about you, Jasmine, but like when people use the term outspoken to describe others, that usually kind of means they're describing them as an asshole in a very polite way. Like, oh, they really speak their mind. But no, it turns out that he is a little mouthy, but he's much more charitable than I initially thought. Special thanks to Posha Recaps, Seinfeld's very own Akiva Wienerker. And also read a response here from Rick Doldersome on our page on robhasawebsite.com. He says, a quick note on Cuban is that he is highly respected by his players and fans for always willing to throw all kinds of money to make the team great, which is much more popular than a penny-pinching owner. You will always see him rooting and screaming behind the bench like a crazy fan instead of an owner in a suit up in his private box. In the 2000s, he also got a ton of fines for criticizing refs and opposing teams, but for every fine he got, he doubled that amount for charity. I think his fines add up into the millions. So it seems like he might be a brash personality, but I think that brash personality actually translates to positivity and effort towards his team rather than just being a guy who doesn't really care and just gets in fights whenever he wants to.
Right. And to sum it all up, they just describe him as the outspoken owner to sum all those experiences up, I guess.
Yeah, I guess if you have to describe it in two words rather than a paragraph than Rick did, I guess they picked the right words, even though, again, it seems like we misinterpreted it. And, you know, after talking about Mark's general demeanor on the show, yes, he might be a bit grandiose, but I mean, you know, he is working towards a good cause. He's not going to openly antagonize anyone, unlike somebody like Mr. Wonderful, who might be more of a grump.
Right. So we can just quickly describe who else is on the panel tonight. So, of course, we have Mr. Wonderful. I don't think he's missed a single episode. He's our original Canadian shark from Dragon's Den, the founder of Softkey, and he sold a children's educational company for $4 billion. We've got Lori Grenier, queen of QVC. It's actually going to be interesting. We're going to have a competitor to the king of QVC on this episode. She began selling jewelry boxes, and that led to her holding several patents and inventions and selling over $500 million worth of products on QVC. And of course, my favorite, Robert Herjavec, yes. Mr. Last Resort Shark. Again, one of the original sharks from Dragon's Den in Canada, son of an immigrant factory worker, and now the owner of a cybersecurity firm, Herjavec Group, and widely considered, I think, one of the nicer sharks on the panel. I'll drop the Last Resort Shark nickname for now.
Exactly. That's resort. The resort has been very much rebuffed and decorated in the past week since Jasmine made that statement. And I would say, before this episode, Robert Herjavec, renowned pet lover. But as we get into this first pitch, it's a pet product, and Robert is out, which is probably one of the biggest surprises to me of this segment.
Right. So let's get right into it. I guess we should always say at the beginning of our podcast, we're not giving anyone investment advice. So just like the television show gives that warning at the front of the show, we're also not advising anyone to invest or buy any of these products, but we're just giving our opinions for entertainment purposes.
Exactly, exactly. Your mileage may vary on your thoughts on these products, but let's start with our first one. For the second week in a row, we are starting off with a pet-based product. Last week was Pride Bites, which focused on customizable designs, products for pets. This one is a little more general and a little more function than fashion. This is called Petnostics. It's a company founded by Stephen Chen and his little dog, Austin. Basically, what it does is it takes this technology from a vet's office. It looks like a series of litmus tests almost, and each square kind of corresponds to a different condition that might exist in a dog's health. And essentially, you get a urine sample from a dog, you pour it on the lid, and you take a picture of the lid with your phone using the app, and the app will kind of run a health test for your dog right there, right then. So if you have to take your dog to the vet, you can have his diagnostics right there.
Right. And it's funny how this episode parallels last week's in terms of starting out with a pet product, because I think I revealed already that I'm not exactly a pet person. But I was actually really intrigued by this product. First, we have to mention how Robert is all over this dog, like always. I love how throughout the pitch, the dog is just chilling in his lap as he's like making his
such
offer.
A well-behaved dog. Like my dog would be bopping around, licking everyone's faces. And I, you know, they say that they're in that room for hours at a time. I wonder how much of that stuff on the cutting room floor was the dog just getting into mischief.
Right. So you mentioned you're a pet owner. I know Ashton said that capturing the urine sample physically was a huge concern of his. Like, as a pet owner, is that something that concerned you at all?
Yeah, so I will say that I initially did buy into this product. I mean, as someone who actually, you know, I feel like if we keep doing pet products, we should do like a This Week on Mike Bloom's Pet progress story. My dog actually had to get taken to the vet this morning at the time of recording it because she broke a nail and it kind of got infected and she had trouble walking on the paw. So we had to take her into the vet. So as someone who had, you know, we got her spayed as well in the past couple months. So as someone who had taken her to the vet a couple times, I could definitely understand like, oh, there's got to be a better way. This would be nice to sort of avoid having to take the trip, having to pay the money just to have a vet check on her, when we would be able to at least run a diagnostics test from the comfort of our own home. But as Justin pointed out, I mean, I think the method of recovery can be a little hard. I mean, I can understand the ladle on a selfie stick concept that Steven brought in, but that's so weird and awkward. Not to mention, my dog is small, and some dogs, or at least female dogs, squat when they pee. You know, male dogs do the whole leg raise, but female dogs, my dog is so small and low to the ground, I would not be able to get that cup in there. And it is, you know, as much of a pet owner, I agree to the fact that, yes, I have to pick up after my dog's poop and do other demoralizing things. I feel like it's even worse to have to like run behind your dog carrying a cup of urine. It would make me look like I'm some sort of drug addict looking for clean urine to get past a test. So I have to kind of run along Ashton's logic here of like, on paper as a concept, I love it, and I think it's totally functional, but when you start thinking out the logistics, then it kind of falls apart.
Right. So let's quickly catch up on the number. So they're he's asking for $300,000 for 10%. He says he retails this for $10, but it costs him only $2 to make one. He says that he can actually get the price of manufacture down to 90 cents. And so far, he sold about 10,000 of these. And I guess various combinations of the product, he was able to get about 4 patents out of this. So in terms of like how I feel about this, again, I'm not a pet person, so I guess I can't relate to what it physically must be like to try to capture the urine from your own dog. But I was really intrigued by this. I like the idea of home testing kits. I think it fits into where we are as a society right now, sort of the WebMD model where people want to get as much medical information as they can on their own before they make the decision to physically go and see a doctor or in this case, a veterinarian. So I was definitely intrigued, even though I'm not someone who would be using this product because I don't have a pet. Ashton is the one who brings up, there are products similar like this that for humans that use the blood samples. And he's asking, you know, why can't you just prick your pet's paw? And I can see how that could be an issue for some pet owners. I think a urine sample is something that's less, they don't want to cause harm to their pets. And I know Robert, he's actually, whenever you think of a pet product, you think he would be the first one in on it. But he was actually not sold on the business model because I think there was some confusion in terms of where they were planning to sell this. And he was actually thinking of the veterinarians, thinking like, you know, don't they want everyone to come see them at the vet's office? So because of that, he's out.
I mean, I could kind of agree. And especially, I think the comparison was warranted because Stephen kept comparing it to a check engine light. And I think similar to a check engine light, you know, there's a whole talk about, and I don't want to offend mechanics that might listen to this podcast, but I feel like there's a stigma behind mechanics that they do tend to overcharge because they know more than you about cars. So they could, for all you know, talk out of their asses in order to overcharge you. And I feel like medicine might be different, obviously, from mechanics, but I feel like vets could do the same thing. And I had to kind of agree with Robert here that if you're trying to push this out through vets, vets aren't going to actively, I feel like, promote a product that says, yeah, this will make you stay away from me. Essentially, this will make you come to me less, so I make less revenue overall. Lori is the one that brought it up. It would make more sense if it was a consumer product. And, you know, he's been making a good amount of money having it be a consumer product, putting it in a bunch of retail stores in Southern California. I don't understand his logic of, oh, yeah, we'll make the vets provide it to them on a recommendation, and they'll totally go for that, psychologically speaking.
Right. And so Mark Cuban comes in, and he says he already has an investment in some sort of blood analysis strip. And he says, you know, strip-driven products have a life cycle, but he doesn't see this as having a long life cycle. He's a bit vague, I think, on his reasons. I think the real reason is that his current investment might be in competition with this. I think that's the true reason that he's getting at. So he's out. And we move over to Ashton again, and he does think there's a market for this. He thinks, you know, I truly believe, even though I'm not a pet owner, I do believe pet owners really care about their pets. There's a lot of products out there that they would spend money on. So that's something that's kind of intriguing to me with this product. There sounds like there's some hesitation with him. And Lori comes in saying, like, I thought you would invest in this because, you know, after this episode airs, which I think she's implying, she thinks the sales are going to go up. And he makes this interesting analogy, a hockey analogy, I think, where he says he tries to stick with where the puck is going and not where the puck is going to be. So what did you think about that line?
Well, I thought he was trying to pull on Michael Scott and, like, loosely quote Wayne Gretzky in terms of these hockey analogies. I mean, again, maybe this is another thing we're finding out about Ashton Kutcher is that he's a huge hockey fan.
Right.
I mean, I guess as an entrepreneur and an investor, you do want to think about it, about, like, not what you're feeling about the product at the time, but where you see the products going in the future, which we'll talk about very much with this whole second screen on the phone product coming up in a couple of segments here, where they were essentially saying, look, you have a great product now, but what's it going to look like in a couple of years? I think when you're thinking about this, and that's what Beyond the Tank is all about, you have to think about the logistics of it for the future and if you can get a return on this investment, essentially. And so I think, again, as lost as I might have been on the sports analogy, and granted, it was a very loose, simple sports analogy, so it held my interest at least somewhat. I think he was correct in his logic here that, you know, as much as he may enjoy this product right now, he feels that because he doesn't really have a business plan moving forward that much, you know, he doesn't have major retails really line up. He doesn't have a business plan outside of just giving it to vets and hoping they'll go by the honor system and give them out to the right customers. He really needed something substantial for Ash to buy in, despite him having a sick dog and understanding the need for this product.
Right. So we move over to Kevin. And so he talks about how he doesn't really see clearly what the market distribution strategy is. Is it retail? Is it online? And he says there's a little bit of risk because this product is kind of pre-revenue, but he actually puts down a deal, $300,000 for 15%. And it's a straight up equity deal. And Ash, I was thinking the same thing. Ashton made the comment, like, there's no contingencies, there's no royalties. This is a weird deal for Kevin because he rarely makes the straight up equity deal.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, he didn't have any of the bells and whistles. We talked even last episode about like the contingency with the, oh, if the Shrek deal goes through, or, you know, Lori saying, okay, I'll loan you this money. And then if you get this purchase order in from Lowe's, I get my money back. And I feel like Shark Tank is a loose enough concept that you can work with those almost amendments to your contract. But yeah, Kevin is usually, and if I'm making a Once Upon a Time allusion here, he basically is the Rumpelstiltskin of the show in that he has a lot of provisions usually added onto his deals, but he didn't this time. It was surprisingly simple, but he then explains that, you know, it's because they're still trying to figure out the market. And since he, like you said, since he doesn't really know the market, he's not going to try to make anything happen because for all he knew, he could be making a provision that doesn't end up working because they go into a completely market whatsoever. The interesting thing to me, and I don't know if you feel the same way, Jasmine, is I feel like Kevin almost made this investment just to sort of like almost get the bidding going. You know, like I don't know how invested he actually seemed in the product itself, but it seemed like he wanted to, you know, kind of spur Lori along. And I think the two of them have enough of an interesting relationship that he knows, okay, if I start the bid to the queen of QBC, she'll definitely bite and go along with it.
Right. I mean, I don't know if I 100% agree that some sharks make bids, but they wouldn't follow up on it necessarily. But I do know, like, there is a process after the show where they don't necessarily need to take the offers that happen during the recording. That's something we could talk a little bit about later. But, you know, he could very well try to spur Lori on because, you know, this could be a product that could sell on QVC, even though Kevin was like, this is not a QVC product. Lori comes in at $300,000 for 20%, which is 5% more than what Kevin offered. And she says, you know what, I think I'm worth that extra 5%. So we have a little bit of a battle happening between Kevin and Lori. You know, he's saying, you know, you don't need her for the extra 5% just because she could get on QVC. And he goes into the story, actually, where he appeared on QVC. And he said that when he appeared in 3 minutes and 40 seconds, he was able to sell, I think, what, $500,000 worth of wine? I think he has a winery company called O'Leary Wines. And I didn't realize that, like, wine was a thing you can sell on QVC. So his point was, I'm the king of QVC. Lori's not special. Anyone can do QVC. You should, you know, come with me for this deal.
Well, if the first season of Celebrity Apprentice is any indication, not anyone can do QVC. Mary Lou Henner could not do QVC. So there definitely is a barrier to entry there. I think the thing you brought up, that Kevin said he sold $500,000 of wine. He sold $500,000 of wine in apparently 3 minutes and 40 seconds, which is ridiculous. I don't know if he stacked the deck with people that would, you know, stage calls to get that much money in that significant amount of time. He doesn't seem like, as much as he may be Mr. Wonderful, I don't know if he really brought the wonder to QVC that allowed people to really drop their money on it in an instant. But yeah, he actually did not mention O'Leary Wines in the previous episode, but in both this week's episode and actually this week's episode of Beyond the Tank, we get a lot of mention of it. I mean, I don't know what's mentioned more at this point, O'Leary Wines or Robert Herjavec having an immigrant father.
Right. So, you know, we have these two offers on the table, and what's his name, Steven? Steven comes back and asks Lori to go down to 15%, basically to match where Kevin is, come down from 20% to 15%. Again, this is where I'm kind of like, does this 5% really matter?
Yeah, and as very they're negligible,
right?
Yeah.
As they're having this discussion, Kevin's like, you know what? What if me and Lori come together and we go back up to 20%? And he's like, you didn't move fast enough, and you just lost the chance to save on 5% equity. So we have a joint offer. I think this is a rare joint offer between Kevin and Lori for $300,000 for 20%. So that's the final offer that gets on the table.
So I have a question here. If we're writing, like, you know, the MB and JS rules for Shark Tank, should one of the rules be, if two sharks go in on one deal for you, you should always take the deal? Because I feel like even if the equity and the percentage might be high, you're still basically getting two for one almost, and that these people will go together and work together for you. Obviously, I think the share of the work might depend. I feel like in this case, Lori might take more of the brunt than Kevin just because she does have these QVC connections. But looking at it just from a purely objective perspective, if I was looking at one shark coming in, or two sharks coming in at the same amount, I would go with two every time.
I would tend to agree with you. I think it really depends on who the sharks are and what they can bring to the table. I think Lori being in any sort of joint deal is extremely valuable just because of what she can do with QVC and like her networks there. I think a different very, like if it was like Robert and Damon together, like I would be really struggling to see like, A, what my product can gain from having those two involved in a single deal. So I wouldn't say flat out that just because two sharks come together, it's instantly a great thing. I think it's the right combination. And I think Lori being in that combination or Mark Cuban being in that combination definitely strengthens the partnership.
Yeah, they're definitely the constant that needs to be in the equation for it to balance the two sides.
Right. So, you know, the deal ends up getting made. It's $300,000 for 20% between Kevin and Lori. And I thought it was a good deal. I think both Kevin and Lori can bring a lot to the table. I do like the product, actually. And I think there is some viability there in terms of, you know, selling these home kits online. I think online is where it needs to rest. I think it fits into what I was saying before, people just wanting to get medical information before they're, you know, physically trekking out to any sort of doctors or vets. So I think this is a good deal.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think the problem with Steven's pitch going in was that it was a great concept, but he had some weird ideas about where he wanted the product to go. And I think with the backing of both Lori and Kevin, they're really going to steer him in the right direction of, hey, don't market this with vets. You know, don't, you know, try to make the ladle at the end of the selfie stick more appealing. So I feel like this has the propensity to do really, really well. If we investigate, if we go back to this though, in the Where Are They Now segment in season 8, I could definitely see it doing really well on the pet market.
Cool. So let's go into my favorite shark, Barbara. She gets to be the star of the shark tank update. So we get to follow her on her annual entrepreneur trip to Cabo, Mexico. Have you been to Cabo before?
I have not been. I think the most south of the border I've been, aside from Florida, is like Kansas, to be honest.
So definitely a perk if you get an investor from Barbara. Apparently, you get these free trips to Cabo, Mexico. So just like last week, where we're able to see Lori's Hall of Fame with her products, Barbara has gathered together sort of her own Hall of Fame. So we see the different entrepreneurs from Tom and Chi, Pipcorn, Bill Custom, Daisy's Cakes, Cousins Maine Lobster. And they're kind of having this like entrepreneur summit where they're just, you know, drinking rosé on the beach and just giving each other investment advice. What did you think about that?
I hope that kid with the braces wasn't drinking that much rosé because he seemed to stick out like a sore thumb. I do forget sometimes, we'll actually see it next week, how like sometimes they do bring in like underage investors to present these products. I think he might have been part of the Billy Customs. Yeah, this was to me weirder than the trade show from last week. Makes a lot of sense because they're presenting their products to people to garner or more business. This was basically like a glorified Q&A session that you might find at a conference where they just sat all along the beach in a staged conversation and just sort of asked questions to each other. I mean, I think they were painting Piper Way, which is a newer product. I think it's like a natural deodorant. They tried to paint them as like the new kids on the block, and they were asking questions about everybody as to what you do. But as you said, you can't give up a free opportunity to go to Mexico, especially on ABC and Barbara Corcoran's dime. But yeah, this seemed to me had less worth than the trade show one of last week. But good to hear that, you know, their combined $1.7 million has gone up to a combined $62 million. That's an insane increase in sales overall.
Right. And I want to say it was like 2 years ago, I was driving to Manhattan, New York from Toronto, and I saw a Cousins Maine Lobster truck on the highway. And I was like, oh my God, it's Barbara's Cousins Maine Lobster. And that has been ridiculously successful for, I think, in terms of all-time Shark Tank products or companies, that's definitely up there. I looked up what was the original investment deal on that. And that was $55,000 for 15%.
Wow.
I don't know what the exact number is with it now. I wasn't sure if it was mentioned in this segment, but I remember reading a 2015 article where it has made $8 million in sales from that year, I think. So
yeah,
that was a blockbuster deal for Barbara, obviously.
And interesting, actually, a lot of food products, and I don't know if Barbara is specifically known as like the food shark, will she'll constantly buy into these. You know, the pitches are divided into various categories, and it is interesting that, you know, sometimes we get people presenting magic shows to go to Las Vegas as a pitch, which is so interesting to me. But one of them is definitely like food trucks, food ventures. I mean, we have a bunch here. Tom and Chi, our grilled cheese and tomato soup. You know, Pip Snacks has that like interesting little mini popcorn snack. Daisy easy cakes is the cakes that are just made to order from scratch. So maybe Barbara just brought all those people down with the hopes that they would just be inspired to make their own food and she wouldn't need to worry about like paying for their food for the duration of the trip.
Basically, you're going to cater this entire Cabo trip, even though it's paid by ABC.
Exactly. It's free, but also you're going to have to work a little bit.
Right. So let's go to the second pitch here. Do you want to start it off?
Yeah, let's talk about Friends, which, again, I'm not too warm on some of these startup titles. This one was pretty bad. It was just, it's like the title of the show, Friends, but just take out the I, which makes sense because I was taken out of this product from the get-go.
Right. So I was so confused because, you know, they have the little title banners at the bottom where it says their name and then the name of their company.
So you thought this was their relationship?
Yeah, so it was like, Sheen and Kier, Friends. I'm like, wait, is that done before? And then I realized, the name of the company is Friends. And I was like, what a terrible name that is.
Did you think you accidentally tuned into The Amazing Race for a couple seconds that you saw their relationship in the lower third?
Right, like mother-daughter, Friends.
Yeah, so these are, as you said, it's Sheen Mohlman and Keir Dillon. So Friends is basically a designer line of fashionable headphones. They basically give the pitch that like everyone walks around with headphones these days and it's tough to like accessorize with them or to make them look fashionable. So essentially what these are customized covers almost to your headphones that you can sort of pop on, and they'll release a batch every season. And they went in with a pretty lofty deal here. $1 million for only 7.6%, though it'll turn out that that's probably because it costs so much to make these types of products, especially the Bluetooth one that they're really trying to champion for the Christmas season.
Right. So, you know, they come up with this very specific ask, $1 million for 7.6% of the company. And they said they sell these for about $150. The large ones go for $200, which is not unusual in terms of the luxury headphone market if you're thinking of like Beats or Skullcandy. Robert's like, you know, you have this ridiculous valuation. You must have a ton of sales. And Keir responds with, and that's what I knew, like, I'm out.
This is something that we might need to clarify because like last week with Coolbox, I was a little confused about what they were talking about. So they said that they had deals with Apple and Best Buy last year, but they lost $1.3 million last year due to, I guess there's like a holdback rule with Apple where they'll just hold on to their product and basically they'll put on the shelves whatever they can. And basically anytime a product is sold, Apple will get the same amount as Friends does. And I guess because they had a lot of their inventory just kind of in stasis, not doing anything, they were losing money. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think that's about right. So from my understanding, so when they first launched, they were able actually to get into Apple and Best Buy, which is great, but it came with this consignment deal that you only get paid for however many that they sell, which is, you know, kind of not a great deal to begin with. And this was back in 2012. They said they sold about 2.5 million, but lost 1.3 million, I guess, because they weren't able to sell that inventory. But they got the product. This is my understanding. They got the product back and was able to sell it through their different retailers like Nordstrom and Bloomingdale online. And now they're actually in a position, even though they had this loss, that they can't keep up with the demand. So year to date this year, they said they've done about 850,000 and they're on track to do 8.7 million, projecting that they're going to blow it out of the park at Christmas. You know, luxury headphones are actually a great gift for Christmas.
And it's going to be, and the cornerstone of that is going to be this new model, which is, you know, I've definitely seen the Bluetooth headphones, the wireless headphones come about specifically whenever I'm in transit. But they're going to turn that into another fashion statement by basically turning one of these Bluetooth sets, which usually wrap around the neck, into a gold necklace, which, again, I am definitely far from the most fashionable person in the world, but in my opinion, Jasmine, and you might differ on this, I thought that necklace looked pretty ugly.
I mean,
yeah. Would that be something you would want to wear every day as an accessory?
You know, I'm a little bit mixed on this, so I can talk a little bit about my personal thoughts on this, but I think we need to get this point across because Kevin does ask them, what are next year's sales? And they say $34 million. And there's this beautiful pause that happens, and Kevin's like, okay, because no one can understand how they can go from having $850,000 year-to-date sales right now to $34 million, and they're pretty much betting it all on this necklace headphone situation, which they say is going to cost $300 to $500 in retail. So I think that's actually a crazy amount. But you know, the headphone market is actually ridiculous. Like, I think I read online that it's expected to be a $12 billion market by the end of 2016. So maybe there's a space in here for this somewhat questionably looking necklace headphone that has come out. So, you know, when I was looking at this necklace, I was like, okay, are people really going to buy this for $300 to $500? But instantly I thought of Kylie Jenner, and here's why. If you can get their entire market strategy should be, if you can get Kylie Jenner to love these headphones and she's wearing them in an Instagram photo, you have a chance. I think you need to get Kylie Jenner on board, and you're going to get all sorts of girls who are going to buy these little bling bling headphones, and it's going to be a thing. If you can't get an influencer like Kylie, then I'm out.
So do we have to, when we talk about these pitches, do we have to include the Kylie factor in it? The chance that like Kylie Jenner might promote this product and it garners. So I know like that I think they talked previously about like, you know, I think Damon, maybe it was last week, said, oh yeah, I'll get you a spokesperson deal. And they'll say like, oh, who are you going to actually, oh, maybe I'm thinking about the I'm thinking about the Cord Buddy. Cause that was one of the most recent episodes I saw where they were talking about like, oh yeah, I could bring in someone to endorse your product. So maybe they, if they promise that they bring in Kylie Jenner, they might be able to buy into it. So yeah, I guess, and then it just looks to me like something you would like steal from a mummy's tomb. It just looked really strange. But like you said, I mean, fashion is weird these days, that if the hottest celebrities are posting these products on social media, they actually do get a good amount of traction on it as a result.
Right. But more worrying than that is the fact that they've mentioned they lost $9 million since inception. So, you know, that fact, along with the fact that they think they're going to go from 2.9 million in sales to 32 million for Kevin, he's like, I'm out, I'm out. And I don't know how you felt about this, but I was actually agreeing with the other sharks. I'm like, there's something shifty with them, just in the way that, like I said, immediately when he was just started off his response to one of the questions as, I was like, I knew this is not something I want to be a part of. Ashton says, I feel like you're hiding something. There's a lack of confidence in the pitch. Even Lori agrees, you know, looks very nice, but I don't have confidence in the way that you're running the business. So, you know, that goes to a certain point where you could have a fantastic product, but you have to sell yourself in a little bit in these pitches. And they gave off the wrong vibe, and Ashton's out, Lori's out, Robert's out, and they don't get a deal.
Yeah. And I think that Ashton actually brought up it up really nicely after they eventually leave the tank of like, hey, if you lost $9 million, own up to it. I want to see you explain yourselves and how that's going to inform your business model. Now, it seems like they almost apologized for it or swept it under the rug, which, as Ashton said, came off very, very sketchy. And I think they're all of the same mindset here, even though they were coming from different perspectives. Lori brought up like, hey, I really can't invest in a company that's lost that much at this point. Robert said, like, I don't know who it's appealing to. And I think the $34 million prediction is astronomically stupid. And then Mark says, like, well, basically it comes down to, you are essentially putting $1 million on this Bluetooth necklace that you're hoping is going to be your big trademark product, but I don't really like it, so I'm out as well. So unfortunately, they walk home empty-handed, though I think in this case, you know, we're going to get two empty-handed deals this episode. I feel like, unlike the one that we're about to talk about, this first one, in my opinion, was completely warranted based on the concept, the pricing, the pitch. It was just all over the place.
But watch, they get Kylie Jenner as a spokesperson next week, and we're all proven wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Where are they now? Well, we got Kylie Jenner to post it on Instagram one time, and now we're at $61 million. So screw you, Shark Tank.
Right. So let's go into the third pitch, which is PopSlate. So why don't you introduce what PopSlate is all about?
Yeah, so PopSlate is the work of a man named Yashar Bazadi. He is asking for $500,000 for 5%. And essentially, he talks about a two-screen experience, though it really isn't as much as it is like more of a convenient second screen. So essentially what it is that they mount a case that has a second screen on the back of your phone, so you don't need to, you know, constantly pull out your phone to check things. You can basically customize this second screen to show sports stats, news, pictures, and social media stuff. I don't think they talk too much about like email or anything like that, so I had a question about that, but it seems to be just really working on the concept of convenience and to save battery life. And it was interesting, as soon as I saw the product, I'm like, oh, that looks kind of like a Kindle screen or a Nook screen. And yeah, it turns out that they took the screen from an e-reader's technology.
Yeah, so we have another phone accessory following from the headphones. My immediate reaction was, I don't really see a personal need for this. I know a lot of people, including myself, that actually use the back of their phones for stickers. Depending on a certain case you can have, you can slip in photos in there. So I don't see anyone dying to really use this space in terms of like, especially for a visually low, you know, Kindle-like e-reader design. Like, if I want to put something on the back of my phone, I want it to be high quality, I want it to be colorful. So the combination of those two things, I just don't think this is something that's actually going to work out. So my initial reaction was, I'm not interested in this at all.
See, interesting. I wasn't personally buying into it because I admit, like, I use my phone mostly for like social media updates to check Facebook, Twitter, etc., and my email. So if those things didn't really feed into it, I mean, I don't really need pictures to show up on the back of my phone. I don't need sports scores, obviously, from my lack of knowledge of Mark Cuban from last week. So it didn't really have a use for me, but I can totally understand, like, if, you know, a businessman is traveling overseas and he wants to just really check his phone while he was flying to see, you know, what the scores might be or what's in the news. I feel like that could be something that's really easy and convenient, but they bring up the big problem here, which is the problem with any sort of technology that orients around phones, and specifically iOS and Apple devices, which is the fact that basically a new Apple device comes out every 6 months. And if you're designing for a certain type of phone, before you know it, another one's going to come out that's like half an inch smaller, and then you basically just wasted all of your product trying to produce for a remedial model.
Right. And I think you mentioned that there could be some convenience factor for like a businessman just to be able to see his ticket. But would you really pay $130, which is what they're selling this for that convenience? Again, so I'm just not convinced. And Ashton brings up, you know, the battery life issue. Mark brings up that, you know, the big competition here is the lock screen. You know, there's a lot of different things he says that you can start to do in terms of just saving information there. So, and then Kevin also comes in and says that he just doesn't think the risk is there with the reward. So Kevin is the first one to go out.
Yeah. And Robert actually brings up an interesting point that he believes that it's going to wearable technology is sort of the wave of the future. And he specifically, I don't think they outright say Apple Watch, but they sort of do the gestures that make you assume Apple Watch. But, you know, Yashar, as much as he is working with Apple products, he does kind of seem to throw Apple under the bus here by essentially saying that the user experience for Apple Watches are absolutely terrible.
Right. And I recently just read an article that like Apple Watch, there's some consideration that it's actually not doing as well as people hope. So I think Robert's a little bit wrong with this, that I don't think the market is like rushing towards the wearable market. So, but anyways, he's out of the deal for, you know, his own reasoning, I guess.
Yeah. And so, as you said, Kevin thinks it's too much for too little. Lori feels like, again, as I talked about before, in the cell phone market, you're always kind of playing catch up. And Ashton is a little worried that they only have a dependency on Apple. They said right now they're only marketing to iOS devices. And because you're in such a segmented market, and as we learned from Friend, especially a market that is kind of cutthroat and will be able to kind of cut you off at the knees, he's out as well. Mark is the last one, though. He doesn't seem to really draw them in on any sort of prospects. He basically says iOS is constantly improving. And he, you know, in addition to, I think, the phone hardware increases, I feel like the technology increase as well is also something interesting that, like you said, before you know it, as soon as they produce all these things, maybe the iPhone 7 will now have like lock screen technology that now puts all your updates up there as well without wasting battery. So basically, because they decided to enter into a medium where everything is constantly changing minute by minute, they're all out. I do feel a little worse for PopSlate than I do for Friends, just because I honestly feel like PopSlate might have been a better concept, but it's just in a much more sharky market.
No, I mean, I think the right decision was made for all the sharks. I already mentioned sort of my personal feelings about this. I don't think this is something that people are dying to have or need. And I think, you know, if this is a genuine need out there, I think Apple is going to definitely come out with some sort of adjustment where you can add more static information just on your lock screen. And I think this is going to fizzle out. He seemed like a nice guy, so I was feeling a little bit bad, but I think the right decision was made for a no deal.
Yeah, and then he seemed pretty positive about it, which is good. He said, like, you know, I learned a lot here. Now I'm going to move on and basically go back to the drawing board, which, I mean, good luck to him. Again, he's in an industry where things are constantly changing, so he might just want to, you know, give up that dream and maybe pursue another, bring that second screen technology to something else. But I thought he at least had a positive attitude about things, which sometimes they don't on Shark Tank.
Right. And so that brings us to our final pitch of the night in terms of people with positive attitudes. I thought these two were great. This is definitely my favorite pitch of the night for Slide Handboards with Angela Ferrando and fiance Steve Watts.
Yes, we got some surfer bros and surfer bras in to talk about this.
Is so it really bras? Because that sounds really awkward.
I guess bros and broettes, maybe. Maybe that sounds more clean.
Yeah, we got to think about that a little more, but go on.
So they get the pre-tape segment. At least one happens per night where they see them on the beach. Maybe the producers just wanted an excuse to go to the beach and film it. But essentially, their kind of sob story is that, as you said, Angela is Steve's fiance, but they basically put all their wedding money into this business. So if they don't get any sort of investment from the Sharks, they essentially have to do a wedding on a shoestring budget. So that was that, you know, those have a little bit of stakes to them. But essentially what slide handboards are kind of surfboards for your hands, basically. I mean, Steve grew up in South Africa, where apparently you can surf with flip-flops. I have no idea how that works, logistically speaking, but, you know, I'll go with
right.
it.
Can I just jump right in and talk about the opening package? Did you notice how Steve threw seaweed at his fiance, and she's, like, swatting him, being like, why did you do that? Did you notice that?
I didn't. Maybe we got an inner glimpse into their relationship. Maybe their lower third on
if
The Amazing Race would be, like, a strange couple.
Just, like, watch the beginning of the package, and he throws seaweed at her, and she's like, why are you doing that? And it's like, starts swatting him, and she must have been like, oh my god, they're catching this on camera, and now it's been broadcast to millions of people.
Yep, exactly. They're gonna see that the man you're about to marry is one that will throw seaweed at you at a moment's notice.
Right. So they come up with this company, Slide Handboards. As you mentioned, they put their wedding money, I guess, into this company, and now they're coming on the Shark Tank and asking for $200,000 for 15% of the company. They retail this for $199 for the carbon fiber version, and they say $169 is the average. They've been doing this since 2011, and they said they sold about $356,000 since they started.
Yeah, so again, I am definitely not in the market for this. I've you know, body surfed a handful of times, but I actually have a fear of open water, so this is definitely not the marketable product for me. Though, again, you know, having body surfed, I'm not so much of a person in the water that I need something to help me surf. I'm very, you know, content just sort of galloping and gallivanting about in the waves. I mean, I think, and this is going to be talked about later, I think what they're trying to market to is a very, very niche audience. Yes, they might be coming from California here, and maybe you can bring some more context into that, considering that you are a new California resident. But I feel like this would not market at all to like anywhere else in the country. And especially as they talked about, if you're marketing it specifically to adult surfers and not to kids as sort of being like, hey, here's a way to surf without having to use a boogie board or a surfboard, I think it's very, very tough to make a lot of money off of this.
Right. I mean, so I used to live in Los Angeles, and I think this, like, I envisioned this product fitting in so perfectly, like on the Santa Monica Pier. Like, you just set up a little shop, you have people just, you know, coming in to visit. You can get these cute little, like, touristy items if you want to just have them as sort of a novelty item, or you can actually use them to, like, try to surf for the first time. So I think sort of a mass market is actually the way for them to go. They did say that their initial sort of strategy was to get into the independent surf shops and have this sort of be a niche, legitimate surf product. Kevin, you know, his concern is, or we should start off with Lori, because she's like, no, I don't think I'm the right partner. She doesn't really give an explanation. Sometimes you're just not into a product. You know, maybe in her mind, maybe she's like, I can't sell this on QVC. So, you know, she's out. Kevin is concerned about the small numbers. He admires sort of their hustle in terms of, you know, putting their wedding money into this. He says it's not for me, but apparently Kevin is registered to able to administer weddings, and he actually offers them to marry them right on the spot on Shark Tank. So what did you think about that?
I mean, if I'm going with power rankings of reality and RHAP affiliates who can marry people, for me, it's going to go Josh Wegler, number one, Stephen Fishback, number two, Mr. Wonderful, number three. I mean,
isn't Jeff Probst, doesn't he have one of those licenses as well?
Is he? Maybe I'd slot him in below Stephen Fishback, just because, I don't know, Jeff Probst, I wouldn't want to be like, Mike is married. I don't want him to end. Yeah, all the fix, the cake. The guests, the bridesmaids, all the fixins. I guess so. Maybe I could have him like Skype in. Maybe I'll say like, okay, Jeff, you can do it, but I'll actually have like somebody else marry me and just have him pretend like he did it. I mean, I think if these people were really jockeying for TV time, they might have done it. I mean, we've had these like Married by America or Married at First Sights shows on reality TV. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that they would actually do it. But I think they're relatively normal people. And so I think they pretty much balked at this idea and said like, thanks, but no thanks, right, which is completely understandable.
I mean, it was just like a fun little bit from Kevin. He brings it up every now and then to show he has a lighter side.
And you also talk about like how he puts bells and whistles on his deals from earlier in the episode. This is another bell and whistle where it was essentially like, hey, I'll offer you this money and I'll also marry you for free.
Right. So we move on to Mark. He's asking how, you know, who's purchasing this product, and they admit that it's mainly 23 to 35 year old men. And they say, you know, the more athletic this product tends to be, it's more higher end, it's more of a smaller market. And he's like, you know, this would do better if it was, you know, that ad product that they had showed an 8-year-old kid, that this could be a surfer starter kit, which is what I was thinking in terms of seeing this on the Santa Monica Pier or any of the piers on the California coast. He does mention that he was invested in an earlier Shark Tank product called Tower Paddle, which is, he says, doing about $10 million this year. So he's thinking, you know, does this fit as sort of an ancillary product with this company?
Yeah, and I think this is another interesting case where we see two sharks partner up again. And Ashton flat out, like, asks Mark, and maybe that's because he is so new that he decides to ask it, whereas maybe the other sharks have such big egos that they just sort of assume people will want to go in on deals with them. But basically, Ashton has the online distribution, and Mark has the previous experience. And as Robert points out, like, when you go after something that's as niche as surfing products, there are a lot of channels that are unconventional in the world of big business that you have to go down. I mean, I think he said, like, it's going to be years and years before I basically get a return on investment with my other surfing product. And Mark has gone down that path. He knows the exact channels they have to go through. So I feel like this was the perfect combination of, you know, basically resources and experience as an offer together.
Right. So they put together an offer between Mark and Ashton, $200,000 for 25%. And I completely agree with you. I think it's the right mix of sharks for them. I think, like, if you're a small little company like they are that says that they are as desperate as they are, they said, you know, our entire wedding and our future is dependent on it. You're getting a billionaire Mark Cuban and a celebrity Ashton Kutcher who want to invest in your product. I think that's fantastic. Yet they come back and they're like, oh, we don't really want to go above 20%. And I'm like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, maybe this should also be in the JS and MB rules for Shark Tank, which is like 5% is negligible. You know, they. I know Mr. Wonderful, I think, or Robert might have said, like, well, 5% down the line is going to be a lot. But it really isn't. Again, if it means getting the support of two very experienced sharks from Ashton Kutcher, a guy whose best known role is basically like a surfer bro type. Like that, you cannot turn that offer away. So I'm glad that they eventually accepted it. I'm very surprised that they ended up bringing it down. And I'm also interested by Kevin and Robert throwing in offers as well, bringing it down to that 15%. Again, I think that might be an example of something I mentioned before of, like, sometimes these sharks are sort of just chumming the waters, proverbially sometimes, just to sort of get a rise out of other sharks. And they knew that, like, oh, I might not care about this product, but let me try to undercut them by offering a better deal.
Right. So Robert jumps in. I actually forgot that Robert wasn't out of the deal yet. He's been kind of a side player in this. And Mark actually, I don't know if you noticed this dig that Mark got into Robert, where he's like, you know, he hasn't learned from his mistakes in terms of, you know, the surfing industry.
Yeah, well, and Ashton, they double teamed him too, because, like, Ashton just kept interrupting his pitch, and Mark says, you know, like, let me finish. And then he pauses, and Ashton's like, okay, this is why I don't let you finish, because you have nothing to say. So Ashton was definitely bringing it this episode from a drama perspective.
Right. And, you know, we thought Kevin was out before, but lo and behold, he jumps in. He's like, you know what? I'll do $200,000 for 15% and I'll marry you guys. So there's the bells and whistles there.
Well, we don't need the second part of the deal, Kevin.
So I guess this provokes Robert to finally put down his deal, which is $200,000 for 15%, which I think is what they originally asked for. So again, we have three offers on the table. We got Ashton, Mark, $200,000 for 25%. We got Kevin, $200,000 for 15%, plus a free marriage. And Robert, $200,000 for 15%. So we got three offers. I think it's clear to everybody who is the team that they need to partner with. But again, they're arguing that they don't want to give up that 5%. So they bring it down to 20% and they ask Mark and Ashton. And Mark comes back actually being like, how about 22?
Yeah, and I'm glad they settled. Again, this is so negligible. Negotiating within 5 percentage points of each other, I just feel like it's useless at the end of the day. So I'm happy that things ended up sorting out the way it did, that Mark and Ashton were charitable enough to bring it down 3 whole percentage points to 22%.
Right, so they close out the deal. I think it's a fantastic deal for them if, you know, they were as desperate as they said they were. You got Mark, who has a surfing company already in his portfolio. We've got Ashton, who knows about online distribution. He's got, you know, name recognition that he can definitely use in terms of helping them along their way. I think this was a good deal for them.
Yeah, I completely agree. And Ashton does his happy dance, so he clearly agrees that it is a good idea as well.
Cool. So we did all our pitches tonight. Should we do a quick recap of, or power ranking of all the products that we saw tonight?
Yeah, this is something new that we want to do after our intro podcast. Since there are only about like 3 or 4 or even sometimes 5 products talked about on a show at any point in time, we'd love to do our review and sort of give our own personal rankings to the product. So I guess I'll go first. My personal rankings, I would probably do PetNostics number 1. Give me slide handboards number 2. I feel like those were the 2 that obviously got the deals, so I feel like they should be 1 and 2. And personally, PetNostics has more of an appeal to me than slide handboards. Give me PopSlate number 3. I know I'm probably more warm on the product than you are, but I think it does have a use. Granted, it'll always be behind in terms of technology and hardware. And give me Friends last, because I don't care about the fashion style of my headphones. It's definitely function above fashion there. So I could care less about this product. So those are my personal power rankings of these products.
So I'm a little similar to you, but my number 1 is different. I'm going to go number 1 with slide handboards. I like...
You would, California.
I know. I could just physically see this product out there. And I think the Ashton Mark combination was really good for them. I think they're going to bring a lot to the table. And I think that's going to be, of these 4 that we saw tonight, I think that's going to be the most successful. Number 2, I would put at PetNostics. I thought PetNostics was good. I just think slide handboards is a stronger product. And then I would put PopSlate 3, and I guess I would agree with you, Friends headphones is number 4, just because they just seem shifty. There's a lot of losses going on, and the headphone market is just way too competitive.
Jasmine, do you have any other thoughts about this episode, or should we start wrapping things up?
No, I thought it was a good episode. We got a little preview for next week. My favorite, Barbara Corcoran, is back next week.
Yes.
But no, I thought it was a good episode. I think just to wrap up Ashton Kutcher's contribution as a guest shark, I thought he did great. I would not be opposed to seeing him come back. Maybe they would even consider him to like add him to the regular rotation. But in terms of ranking the guest sharks that I've seen over the years, I would definitely put him near the top.
And better than Jeff Foxworthy?
Better than Jeff Foxworthy, yes, 100%.
That's definitely like the replacement level line of guest shark. No, I agree. I was very much entertained. And I think going into the episode, we were both a little double WTF about like, what is he going to bring to the table? But I think he brought the perfect level of professionalism, energy, and just general good TV aspects. And he did go in on a deal, which is good. And though I imagine, as you said before, I don't think they would have really had, they wouldn't have mixed these episodes, this episode together, had he not gone in on at least one deal. But it's good to see him own basically half of this stake of slide handboards.
Right. Now, I thought it was a good episode overall. And I'm kind of sad that we're coming to the end of the 7th season already, even though we just got started.
I know, exactly. But I do want to talk a little bit about Beyond the Tank, but not right now. I know a good amount of you said after we talked last week about how neither one of us watched Beyond the Tank and we would love to know exactly what it's like. You guys expressed to us that it's a good show. It's definitely a lot more serious than Shark Tank is, which I was a little saddened about, because part of the fun of watching Shark Tank is how ridiculous some of these pitches and the shark interactions can be. But that being said, we do plan on covering episodes of Beyond the Tank at some point. We're still working out logistics for the next couple of weeks, but I will guarantee you that not only will we talk about Beyond the Tank at some point, we also will be talking about past episodes as well. As you said, Jasmine, we are jumping in at a very late point in season 7, and I know a lot of people were asking us, what are your favorite pitches of the past? You know, what are your favorite episodes? So we'll definitely have an opportunity to look more into that, especially since, you know, it'll be a long off season before season 8 comes about.
Right. I mean, like, if we finish off the season and you guys like what we're doing, we have an entire summer where maybe we can go through some of the best pitches of the past. Like, I was thinking we can go through the original Scrub Daddy pitch and see how that went, or yeah, Squatty Potty. So we would love to hear your ideas in terms of pitches that you loved in the past, episodes that you love that might be good for us to revisit.
Yeah, and we'd love to hear your feedback in general. Again, we are very appreciative of the feedback we got for our intro podcast, so keep the comments and questions coming. You can always leave a comment on this page here on Reality TV Rehab Ups on robhasawebsite.com. And while you're here, make sure you're subscribed to the Reality TV Rehab Ups feed. Jordan Parhar is doing great stuff on the Reality TV Rehappy Hour, and there's also occasional coverage of The Challenge, The Bachelor, Bachelorette, Bachelor in Paradise, Top Chef, etc., etc., all sorts of great stuff. And of course, you can always reach out to us on social media. I'm at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter. Again, Jasmine, for people that did not listen to our first podcast, how can people reach out to you on social media?
Yeah, so you can reach me on my Twitter handle, which is just my first and last name together, Jasmeet Sidhu, J-A-S-M-E-E-T-S-I-D-H-U. And I got some questions about this last week in terms of what exactly I do out here in Silicon Valley. So if anyone's interested in that, you can visit my website, which is just jasmeetsidhu.com.
Perfect. Jasmine, great job again. We're thrilled to have you back on a recurring basis now to talk about Shark Tank.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Let's go with the hashtag the Kylie factor, just so we can get this out into the ethos that maybe we can make this a recurring thing to say, well, maybe a pitch becomes, you know, it didn't save Friends from being the bottom of our power rankings this week, but it might save a pitch later on.
Hashtag the Kylie factor. I like it.
Perfect. All right. So thank you guys so much for listening. We will be back to talk about the next episode of Shark Tank Season 7. But for now, the tank is closed.